practice.
All right. Before we get to the rest of the show, we have Above the Noise. Here's Dan Patrick.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome, great to have you with us. Show brought to you today by our good friends at Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury. A regular stop for Kevin after this show.
That's true.
What causes that?
The start of the weekend. Yeah, that's it.
Just want to make sure.
Yeah, that's what it is.
I just want to make sure. I want to make sure you're okay.
What am I going to watch this weekend, by the way? There's no IndyCar race. They don't start opening up the track till next week. There's a little bit of baseball. I could watch some baseball.
Yeah, that'd be great for you. Good, go for it.
Penguins playing this weekend again?
Yeah, they play tomorrow. We're going to talk about with Tony DeFazio, Pittsburgh Sports Report.
Well,
they play at the Islanders tomorrow night.
I want to be prepared. I mean, I did watch last night's. I watched last night's second period, and there was a lot of action. If you like to watch Penguins hockey,
most certainly is. Talk about that in a little bit here.
Tell you what, Sidney Crosby made a move on the second goal, on his first goal, the second goal of the game. That was just unreal.
I know, special player, isn't he?
Oh, and they even tried to bounce him. I mean, and he barely moved. It was just amazing.
Yeah, very special player. You really can't appreciate how good he really is. Because, look, how often have I talked about when it just comes to a quarterback that you have to really know where all the chess pieces are on the field? Quarterback has to know where all 21 pieces are. I mean, the great ones, you know, Brady, Manning, Breeze, Rodgers, Roethlisberger. Vic, just kidding. I mean, they know where all the chess pieces are. And it makes a big difference. Well, Crosby knows where all 11... where the other 11 players are. It makes a huge difference.
For the first time, and I haven't seen every period of every game, I've seen bits and pieces of every game, but for the first time, it actually looked like the Penguins were playing like the top spot and the Islanders were just getting into the playoffs.
Right. And what they did was Vokoun gave up a lot of big rebounds last night. Big rebounds. But you never once saw the Islanders get a second shot off a rebound, did you? That's because the Penguins did a great job on the forecheck last night. The Penguins did a great job on the backcheck last night. Neutral ice, they were really good. And not only that, but I don't care who it was, forward defenseman, they cleaned up in front of the net, and if there was a rebound, the Penguins claimed it, cleaned it, cleared it, whatever they had to do. There was never back-to-back shots on Vokoun off a rebound.
Well, and
huge.
What you were talking about with Fleury, the issues that he was having earlier in the series, mm-hmm. seemed to be what the Islanders goalie had last night. I think it was the third shot. Murray put one. Yeah. It like flipped over his shoulder and then dropped it behind him over the line.
It did, and that was a foul-up. That was no question. That goal was a foul-up. Now, the other three Penguin goals, Crosby, of course, got one himself.
That
but
was amazing.
The pass he made to Iginla was just phenomenal. And then the one to Letang, feathered it between two guys, and Letang just came in and fired it. Incredible. Big lacrosse weekend coming up here. Women's lacrosse team, Canisius. They're the number 7 seed NCAAs. Other half of the bracket being played out here as well today is UConn-UMass. Tomorrow, men, First time since 2005 in the tournament. They will take on Yale tomorrow at 2:30. We welcome in the head coach of the Nittany Lion men's lacrosse team, Jeff Tambroni. And, Jeff, congratulations on what you've accomplished so far.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Let's talk about your team as to how you've been able to put this together. Do you like the balance that you have and the depth you have, especially at the midfield spots?
You know, some weeks we've had a little bit more depth and a little bit more balance than others. I will say this. I think each year we've gotten a little bit better. When I first got here, you know, a lot of the guys that are playing for us right now in their junior year took their lumps. I mean, I can remember back in our first year here, a lot of those guys that were starting for us and playing for us were freshmen. And we went through some tough times. And then last year, you know, they got a little bit better. The little tougher skin, gained a lot of valuable experience that first year. And then we had some others who stepped in as freshmen last year, two defensemen in particular, started for us and, again, took some lumps because of maybe a lack of maturity. I think we've gotten to the point now with the combination of Jack Forrester and Travis Crane in their fifth years, along with our seniors, juniors who have played for us for now two and a half, three years, and now sophomore class, we at least have not just depth, but we have a little bit more maturity on the field. And I think that's shown down this last 5 or 6 week stretch that we've had, and hopefully that's going to carry us into the playoffs. Yeah,
you mentioned Jack Forrester. Here's a guy with better than 100 goals in his career. He's been outstanding on the attack. You're on what he has brought to the table and the maturity of his game.
You know, I can't say enough about Jack. He, you know, made a commitment when last year's season ended. You know, last year's season ended in a lounge, in the East Area Lounge, when we saw the fact that Penn State not made it to the playoffs. And, you know, at that point, I don't think his mindset was telling him to come back to Penn State and finish off. I think he was going to graduate. He had three knee surgeries. But I think once the news of the season ending, you know, certainly in that regard, he put a lot of time and effort into it and put the paperwork in, and he made the commitment not just to Penn State Athletics, but to his teammates, himself, to come back and make one more run at this thing and try to get us through that spot that we ran into last year. And, you know, his leadership has just never wavered. And I'd say one of the things that probably goes unnoticed with Jack is just his poise in practice, his poise in some times of adversity, and without question, his poise on the field when things are at their worst. You know, when it seems like we've hit a crossroad in every game, he seems to be the guy that's able to kind of play our way out of it. And, you know, without Jack, I'm not sure where we'd be right now. I'd say it'd be hard-pressed to say that we'd be in the playoffs. So we're very thankful that he decided to come back. I think he's left quite an impression on this particular program. And the guys that are now playing for it, and his legacy will be very difficult to replace.
At the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of experience is T.J. Sanders, who was second-team All-CAA, but was also the CAA Freshman of the Year. Kind of marksman is he developing into on the attack? Because, I mean, you know, Sturgis and Forrester seem to do a good job of getting him the ball.
Yeah, well, I think you make a great point, though. He has benefited from the maturity and the leadership of Jack and Shane, who have both been around for, you know, 3 and 5 years respectively. And, you know, he came in, he had unbelievable skill set when he first walked on campus. But the one thing that TJ has developed, and I think a lot of that is because of the experience that Jack and Shane has provided him, is he's becoming a pro in regards to his preparation, his film study, has gotten better and better each week, and his work ethic. I think that's the biggest change from day one till right now. He's a completely different young man, and he just works tirelessly through the course of a Monday through Friday preparation work week to get to Saturday. So what most people don't see is how hard he works in the film room, how hard he works on the practice field to get to that point. So, you know, for us, it's finally gotten to that point where it's starting to be handed down where it should be, the natural progression of your seniors and juniors, leading by example, expressing the way it should be, whether it's leading on the field or communicating the standard that we'd like to set, and making sure that they maintain that standard from everybody, including themselves. And I think TJ has clearly been the benefactor of that.
You're not going to get things rolling unless you win faceoffs. And Danny Hennigan is a guy that was first-team All-CAA as a faceoff guy. I mean, better than what, 57, 58, almost 60% of the faceoffs he gets. What does he do, Jeff, that allows him to be a quality faceoff man? Not only is he a quality faceoff man, but also he's one of your leaders in ground balls.
Yeah, you know, you have to have the mentality. I would say there's two positions on the lacrosse field that just require just a little bit of a different mentality. You're in that, you know, that goal area. You have to have a special mindset and mentality, and you're at the faceoff X. Special mindset and mentality, and both positions remind me a lot of a wrestler. You know, you put yourself on the mat, and it's just you against your opponent. And it, you know, even though it's a team sport, it's more a one-on-one battle. And you know, I'd watch and admire the way the Penn State wrestling team has conducted their business over the last 3 years, my time here, and they're as hard a working a group and as tough a group, both mentally, and I'd say even more so mentally than they are physically. And I think you have to have that mindset. So Danny's done a great job of bringing the mental edge into that circle, into the face-off X. And he just works hard. I mean, it's a position that, you know, it's tough. You go out there and most of the guys are in the flow of practice. And lacrosse is a lot like basketball in the fact that it's going up and down. You're on offense, you're on defense. And, you know, it's an enjoyable game to practice as much as it is to play because there's so much flow. But as a face-off guy, you spend the majority of your time on your own with our face-off coach in the corner basically wrestling with a cross sticks, and it takes a mindset, a very tough mindset, to go over there and do what they do for 2 hours every day to battle one another, both mentally and physically. And, you know, we feel very fortunate. Danny's got a ton of experience. I mean, he's taken the majority of face-offs since the day we walked on campus, so I don't even know the number, but I would say it's probably upwards of 800 to 900 face-offs over his career. And, you know, with each and every face-off, he's learned a lot. And I think he's brought that maturity and that approach to the field. And, you know, there's never been a week, probably more important than this week, where we need him more because of our opponent. I mean, they have one of the best face-off guys in the country. So it's going to be a great battle, and we're going to need Danny to be at his best in order to give ourselves a level playing field against Yale.
You mentioned the mentality needed to be a good face-off person out there at the X. You also incorporated your goalkeeper when it came to talking about a different mentality. That, of course, is Austin Kaut, player of the year, not just defensive player of the year, but player of the year in the conference. You know, about 7 goals a game he gives up. Save percentage is fabulous. What has made him and allowed him to develop into somebody that's special, dependable, and really can turn a game for you?
Now, two words come right to mind as you're asking that question. One is just a competitive nature. He has an unbelievable competitive nature. So he's an extremely competitive young man. The other one would just be consistency. Yeah. He's just every day he comes out and he's prepared to work. It's ultra focused. You know, has a great degree of concentration on a daily basis. And you know, in this day and age, when you're working with 18 to 21, 22 year old young men with an academic load and, you know, all the distractions that are going on here at college. The moment he steps on that field, as good as anyone I've ever been around, he is absolutely focused on the task at hand. So I think he's got some intangibles other than just good hand speed, great reaction time. I mean, the intangibles that he brings to the table certainly separate himself. And in my mind, he is as good as it gets. I mean, he's everything you know, that you see or that you read about with that young man. I've been working with goalies my entire career in my 13 years as a head coach. He's as good as I've ever been around.
You, of course, would have a very, you know, good handle over the years on Yale and what they bring to the table. What about this particular Yale team? What is going to make this, you know, you get to this point to tell the audience, no matter what, you're going to face a really good opponent. What makes Yale a really good opponent for you on Saturday?
Yeah, well, first, I agree with you in this regard. I mean, there's a few automatic qualifiers that you know, rank in the bottom of this top 16. Other than maybe one or two schools, everybody in this tournament, I'd say, and certainly this year more than most, has a chance to actually, you know, move on to that Final Four setting or even win a national championship. So every game is going to be nip and tuck. So you're going to have to play as about as well as you've played all year if you expect to move on. And Yale is playing real well as of late. They've had a great year, 11-4, and have gone through an Ivy League, which has got, you know, from top to bottom, one of the better leagues in the sport of lacrosse. And, you know, they've done it with possession time first and foremost. Their faceoff guy is the number six faceoff guy in the country, and he's done a wonderful job for them over the last couple of years with, you know, some teammates on the wings of faceoffs that have made them very good. They've been very patient in the offensive end in conjunction with winning faceoffs. So not only are they dominating possession time off the faceoff X, but now they're pretty patient in the offensive end, which, you know, against some opponents – can get you going a little bit trigger happy when you get the ball into the offensive end and be a little bit out of context or start to rush some shots or rush an offense. And I think they've just been true to who they are. I mean, they've been patient along the board. They got a very mature defense. They got four senior defensemen out of the six guys playing for them. So they got a lot of things going for them, as well as some experience in the playoffs last year. They were able to advance into the playoffs for the first time in some time in Yale history last year. So they got that going for them as well. So I'd say with the combination of possession time, certainly, you know, moving the ball into their offensive end, with the maturity of their defense, with the experience of that from last year, that makes them a pretty dangerous opponent. And, you know, we understand how good they are and how well we're going to need to play in order to advance. But that's what this is all about right now. And I think the maturity of our guys, regardless of whether or not we've been in the playoff game in any one of these guys' tenure, I think is going to have little significance on this in this particular game. I think it's going to be, you know, just decided on the field. And I think our senior leaders have done enough to prepare this particular group to be ready for the task at hand.
One final question, because I know you're very busy making sure you button down everything for the task at hand. Everyone knows that both lacrosse teams have made it. The women will play tomorrow at 4. Missy's team will get Canisius. Should they win, they would come back Sunday and play the winner of UMass UConn. You have that your important NCAA matchup sandwiched in between Saturday at 2:30 at Yale. What do you think it means for the sport on this campus that both are at this point and this weekend showcases both at home?
Level there, it has been our vision. I would say, and I don't want to speak for Missy, but I would just say, from conversations that I've had with her, I think it's been our vision, our collective vision, to just help the sport of lacrosse grow within the athletic department. And when we first got here, you know, we could see how antiquated it was compared to where we both were. I was at Cornell, and she was at Towson, where lacrosse was a high priority sport, and there are just so many sports here at Penn State that are so successful that it was just, you know, near the bottom in that totem pole of popularity around the State College area. And so it's been nice to just see just step by step. I mean, just an incremental move forward on campus. The crowds that we've had from year one to year three have grown significantly. The awareness of the sport on campus has grown significantly. And then, you know, being the father of three girls, two of which, my two oldest play lacrosse and my wife coaches, it has been so fun to watch the community and how lacrosse has grown as a sport, both in the boys and the girls level. And, you know, it's becoming a little bit more of a commonplace within the school. So Missy's done a great job of getting out and about and, you know, speaking to the community about the sport of lacrosse, putting on clinics as well. So, you know, I think it's both of our dreams that, you know, when we got here, at least looking out, you know, 5 to 10 years from now, to have it more of a mainstream sport and to make it a little bit more popular, not just at Penn State, but in the state college community. And I know with the athletes around this community, this could be a pretty special place for the sport of lacrosse.
Jeff, your team has accomplished a lot so far this year. There's still more to be accomplished, but also at the same time, for fans out there, you play a very, very entertaining game to watch. We wish you nothing but the best of luck this weekend and down the road.
Steve, thanks so much. It's an honor to be on your show.
Jeff Tambroni, the head coach of the Nittany Lion men's lacrosse team. Bucknell plays great lacrosse
as well. Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm sorry to cut you off there, Steve, but you're absolutely right, and that's what I wanted to add in. Bucknell's success in lacrosse has also broadened the audience for lacrosse in this region. I've seen an uptick in lacrosse interest over the last 10 years more than any other sport, and that includes soccer. That's just my opinion.
I just think Bucknell has had great success. Now, it didn't pan out for them in the tournament, but they are – Bucknell is a program that was in the top 10 most of the season. In fact, for Penn State, one of the more significant regular season wins they had was at Bucknell. So, I mean, if you're seeing Bucknell playing at a high level and you see Penn State playing at a high level – in the central part of the state, and we're seeing more and more lacrosse programs on the high school level now, becoming a very popular sport on the high school level.
Well, I think a lot of that, Steve, is because it is a fast-paced game. There's a lot of action and potentially a lot of scoring as well.
Right. I announced three games last week on Comcast Sportsnet from Boston, D.C., Philly, up and down the coast. I've done lacrosse before, but it's just a great game. It was a fun game for me to announce, especially the championship game. I had a blast doing that. All right, we have news coming up bottom of the hour. Tony DeFazio, Pittsburgh Sports Report on the Pens and the Islanders. We'll come back with more on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Today's show brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. And by the way, special thanks today going out to our great friends from the volunteers of Hummel's Wharf, Northumberland, Winfield, Americus Ambulance, Shamokin Dam. Also to Jack Grove, the assistant fire chief of Shamokin Dam. All those volunteers, thank them so much. Although the picture that Lauren sent me of the transmitter is something that it's just not, I'm not going to frame it.
It was an entertaining day, and I had a chance to see some of the guys that help you out behind the scenes. You really don't see them unless there's an emergency.
Excuse me, but how many times have I said on this show that the most valuable individuals and the greatest bargain any community has are volunteer fire and EMS?
Absolutely.
I've said that how many times? I mean, they're even more valuable and a greater bargain than Lawrence. That's saying something.
And that's a bargain.
I mean, look, we have to come up with a lot of money to pay Drew Kelly. I mean, I got it. All right. Tony DeFazio, Pittsburgh Sports Report. Penguins rolling through the playoffs. Kevin even watched last night. Tony, how about that? Welcome to the show.
Always good to be here. Thanks, Steve.
Tony, let's start with Thomas Vokoun. It was an obvious move to make. Everyone knew he was going to make the move. Your thoughts on how he played, but also how well they played in front of him last night?
You know, I think it took a little bit of time for both of those things to gel. I think they were a little bit shaky early. He was a little shaky early. He bobbled a couple of shots, and I think they got some fortunate bounces in the fact that there was nobody, you know, right in front to poke away the rebounds whenever they were there. But I think as time went on, as the first period went on, the team played a lot better in front of him, and he really during that entire first period, he made some saves, frankly, that we didn't see Marc-Andre Fleury make throughout this series. And I think that maybe gave his team some confidence. The other side of this is he's a calm guy. He's been a calming influence all season. He's an older guy. He's 36 years old, so he's been through a lot of battles before. But at the same time, he has that desperation to win a Stanley Cup and, frankly, just to compete in the playoffs. And I think all of those things combined, plus the fact that some of those Penguin defenders feel like they contributed to getting Marc-Andre Fleury benched as well. And I think all of those things sort of combined to see the team, play what was probably their best game of the playoffs so far.
Into Game 6, can it be assumed that he gets the start again?
I think it can, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine Dan Bylsma benching him after he comes in and, you know, throws a shutout against a team that did put 31 shots on him, that did, you know, that does have a lot of offensive talent. I mean, we saw, you know, he made kind of that seminal save on John Tavares when he really made Paul Martin look bad by, you know, just stick handling the length of the ice pretty much, and or at least the length of the Penguins offensive zone. And he stood up tall and made that save. And, you know, I just think he, I don't want to say saved the series for the Penguins, but he certainly got them back on track. And I think he will get the start on Saturday. Dan Bylsma wouldn't you know, confirm one way or another. But I think I'd be very surprised if they went back to Fleury at this point. I think at some point, assuming that their season continues, you'll see Marc-Andre Fleury in net again. But I don't think that's going to be Saturday.
Right, and I agree with that. I think moving forward, at some point you'll see him again. But I think while you have a hot hand, you ride your hot hand. The next part,
you know,
of
I think those things have a tendency to work themselves out, too.
Right.
If the Penguins continue to win, I wouldn't be surprised if the move back to Fleury becomes an obvious one as well.
Next part is Sidney Crosby. We know, as watching him over the years, how truly great he is. When you watch somebody who understands where all the chess pieces are on the ice, what is that like to watch when you see it in person?
I mean, it's just amazing, you know, and that goal yesterday was one of those moments that you just say, wow, you know, did that just happen? And, you know, it's interesting. I just referred to the John Tavares play where he, you know, got Paul Martin. Paul Martin had real good defensive position on him, and Tavares still stick-handled back and forth and got a great shot off. And then it was just moments later that Crosby one-upped Tavares, who is a rising young star, one of the best young players in the league. But to me, that was almost a microcosm of what this series could be, where you see a great young player who doesn't quite have what Crosby has or what the Penguins have as a team. Now, that obviously will sort itself out here in Game 6 and perhaps 7, but, you know, that's the difference between a great player and Crosby. Just a couple minutes after that, you see Crosby just, you know, show such great strength to blow through the defenders, and neither of those defenders followed Jerome Iginla to the left side of the ice. He went to the left side of the ice. Both guys stayed with Crosby, and he still split them and fired the puck past Nabokov. It was really one of the moments of his career, and kind of one of those moments that, you know, at the end of his career, that's one of the four or five goals you're going to see on the highlight reel, and that's one of those moments that makes you kind of come out of your seat and almost violate that, you know, no cheering in the press box code. You can certainly gasp in the press box, and Crosby makes a lot of people do that.
For the Penguins, in a series like this, whether it's the NBA or the NHL, the one thing that's very important is that you do make adjustments from game to game. What adjustments have you seen that allowed the Penguins to go from a couple of mediocre performances back-to-back to one of their better performances in weeks?
Yeah, I think some of them were as simple as making lineup changes. And Dan Bylsma has always had a tendency to stick with a lot of his favorites, especially third and fourth line players. That's what Dan Bylsma was. He was that level of a player, kind of a grit guy, not really a great skill guy. And he's had a tendency to ride some of those third or fourth line guys. Well, he made some changes in the lineup. Tyler Kennedy got himself back into the lineup. Joe Vitale got himself back into the lineup. And Simone Dupree, a very young but very fast defenseman who did not have a good game the first game he played in this series, was benched after that, came back off the bench to play in Game 5. Those three guys represent a ton of speed, and I think that the Penguins knew the Islanders had a lot of young talent and a lot of young speed. I don't think they anticipated it would fluster the Penguins lineup the way it did, and I think he made a great adjustment by going with the speed and maybe allowing the Penguins to open it up a little bit more when, you know, giving up so many goals, you might think the opposite to be true. But I think the other side to that, Steve, I think that he just, you know, I think the players made some adjustments to get back to the kind of play that they had been, you know, used to during their long winning streaks this year, and that's playing solid in their defensive end. Part of his defensive pairings were putting Dupree with Chris Letang and maybe forcing Letang to play a more conservative game because he had this young guy playing next to him, and I think that maybe cut down on some of Letang's turnovers and stuff too. So I think those were some, you know, some big adjustments. The goaltending adjustment was an obvious one. And the other thing he did is one that I think people have been waiting about a month for, and that was to play Jerome Iginla with Sidney Crosby. Sidney Crosby likes to play with the line he played with all season, Pascal Dupuis and Chris Kunitz, but you know, they got Ginla to play with Crosby. That was the reason the trade was made, and it took him about a month to do it and certainly four games of the playoffs to do it. But in the second period, he did make that move, putting Ginla with Crosby, and it certainly paid off.
Malkin played a really good game last night. But again, Malkin's not putting the puck in the net, but he played very well last night. How much can he change the tone of the entire playoff if he can somehow find the net with some consistency?
Yeah, that, he's one of those guys in the NHL. There's probably just a handful of them, and he's one that can do that. He can change the, you know, he can change the momentum of a series, and he can change the focus of a team's defensive efforts by doing what you just said. He's playing with a bum shoulder. It's given him trouble all season long. They've given him some practice time off, I think, to rest the shoulder now that they're in the playoffs, and I think you'll probably see that continue. But Malkin's a guy that can disappear for long stretches, and then when he finds his game, he can dominate for, you know, short spurts. So if the Penguins can continue to win and continue to play and continue to have a next game, I think the chances are that you're going to see that at some point. And in the past, we've seen him pick up and dominate for a game or two or even longer. And obviously the Penguins are going to need that at some point if they're going to win 16 games like they fully anticipated doing before these playoffs began.
The Pirates had a good start. They've fallen back just a bit, Tony. With the Penguins in the playoffs and the passion surrounding it, I know the TV ratings are huge. Are the Pirates again taking a back seat in the city because of all this?
You know, yeah, they are. They are. You know, it's funny just to hear some of the comments, you know, after last night. Hey, the Pirates, you know, it was a close one, but I'll take a Pirates loss for a Penguins win at this point in the year. And I think you'll probably see a lot of that as well. May not be a bad thing for the Pirates to take a back seat occasionally. Obviously, they haven't performed well when the spotlight's been on them in the past. So, yeah, but there's no question. I really haven't seen, you know, this Penguin following has grown and grown and grown. And for the first time, Steve, I don't want to say it rivals the Steelers fan base, but in that setting and in its moment, it can be as rowdy as a Steeler fan base. And it really has been something to see over the past week or so.
Tony, the TV ratings for the Penguins are huge. I believe they have the highest local TV rating of any team in the league.
It's been unbelievable. It really has. And I think, you know, again, I mean, you take a look at, you know, not only do you have draws like Sidney Crosby, but then you bring in a guy who's an NHL legend in Jerome Iginla. You know, and now there's some subplots to this thing. They're struggling. They're getting tested. And I think even some of the casual fans are tuning in to say, wow, you know, what's going on here? Why are they getting tested? So, you know, they certainly make for some drama. Even a 4-0 game has its share of drama, like yesterday's did.
Well, I think, look, it's the two teams, I know NBC is just aching. They're lighting candles at St. Patrick's as we speak. They want Chicago and Pittsburgh in, I think, so badly. They've got Chicago moving on. They took out Minnesota with complete ease. How important, I mean, you want to close out whenever you get a chance to close out, because Ottawa's already done it. How important, though, would it be for the Penguins, just in terms of the grind of the season and a compressed schedule now to the playoffs, if they can somehow close out tomorrow night?
And I think it's huge. I mean, if there's seven games, it's going to be back-to-back, Saturday and Sunday. I think that kind of a situation favors the Islanders. The Islanders feel like, at least it seems as if, they feel like they're playing you know, on the casino's money at this point. I mean, you know, they're not playing with a lot of pressure. They're out there just skating and having fun. I think they're a young team that has pushed a lot of boundaries and broken down a lot of walls already just to be where they are. So, you know, I think all of a sudden the momentum swings back into New York's favor if they win on Saturday with that quick turnaround. So, yeah, I absolutely think it's huge for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the Penguins' age and the fact that they need to get a little bit of rest. But also I think that, you know, this is a team that hasn't been challenged like this before, and so far they've responded, but the Islanders have responded every single time as well. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me one bit to see a seven-game series happen. The last time the Islanders forced a seventh game in Pittsburgh, that was when David Volek scored an overtime goal. That was about that. Well, that was 20 years ago, and that was one of the lower moments in Penguins franchise history. So, you know, even though you have completely different rosters, that's something that the fans don't want to remember.
Right. What was the reaction, even though we're out of season, but to have Penn State and Pitt playing the ACC Challenge at the Pete.
I think everyone's excited about that. I mean, again, I think, you know, even though basketball doesn't hold the same rivalry and the same feelings that football does, I just think it makes sense. And again, when you look at Pitt's non-conference schedule over the past couple of years, playing a legitimate Division I team is something that the fans certainly embrace. So, yeah, I think that's something, you know, playing a Big Ten team, playing a local team, and there's a connection. John Johnson will be, I don't know if he'll be playing in that game.
He will
game,
not be eligible,
He will not be
able to play in that game quite, on December 3rd.
Okay.
No.
But still, you certainly like those connections, and I think that's something that everybody's going to embrace, no question.
Tony, always a pleasure. Have a great weekend.
Sounds great. You too, Steve.
All right, Tony DeFazio, Pittsburgh Sports Report, joining us to talk about the Pens and other issues. We'll wrap it up with a very interesting map that Sarah Bartlett sent me. Although I'm a little concerned that it has only 47 states on. As we return here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Sunbury Motors is having their 65th annual new Ford truck sale.
65 years of saving.
Choose from over 160 new trucks with savings up to $11,000. The number one selling truck in the world for 36 consecutive years is the Ford F-150. And Sunbury Motors has them on sale as low as $20,954. SMC has a huge selection of hardworking Super Duty trucks, including Super Cabs, Crew Cabs, Diesels, and Duallys. Sunbury Motors has over 40 of the total redesigned 2013 Ford Escape, starting from just $20,975. The hot-selling 2013 Ford Explorer is slashed $3,300, with 4x4s priced as low as $29,930. This is Central PA's largest truck sale of the year. Hurry into Sunbury Motors in the Reform Street Auto Plaza during this unprecedented 65th annual May New Truck Sale. Sunbury Motors, proudly serving the Susquehanna Valley for almost a century. Hurry before someone gets your truck.
The best get-togethers start with a trip to the beverage supermarket, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury. Why? Because Brewers Outlet has not only a great selection of beer, including imports and microbrews, but also a lot more. Brewers Outlet has water, soda, they roast their peanuts every day, and you can't forget about stopping by the pickle bar. Look for great deals on wine coolers and all your favorite snacks. Before you enjoy those special times with family and friends, make your visit first to the beverage supermarket, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury.
All right, today's show brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 to 15, Hummel's Wharf. Hilster's General Store Hotline, 800-795-9565. Hilster's General Store, 7 miles south of Sealands Grove, Routes 11 and 15. So Sarah Bartlett sends us this map. Highest paid state employees. And across the board, like Steve Sarkisian in Washington, Steve Alford at UCLA, Sean Miller at Arizona, Mack Brown in Texas, Billy Donovan in Florida, Mark Richt at Georgia, Brett Bielema in Arkansas, Les Miles in Louisiana, Bill O'Brien in Pennsylvania, Urban Meyer in Ohio, Bo Ryan in Wisconsin, Tommy Izzo in Michigan, Tom Crean in Indiana, John Calipari, highest paid state employee in Kentucky, Bill Self, highest paid state employee in Kansas, Gary Pinkel in Missouri. Okay. Kirk Ferentz, highest paid in Iowa. It's a bit misleading. Gina Oriema is number one in Connecticut, for example. The med school dean in North Dakota, med school dean in South Dakota, the college president in Montana, the med school plastic surgeon in Nevada, the college president in Alaska, med school chair in New York, college president in Vermont, law school dean in Maine, and the med school chancellor in Massachusetts. The only states where a coach is not number one.
Yeah, but New Hampshire's the funny one.
Well, that's hockey. Well, that's the number one sport there.
Right, right. But aren't they known as the University of No Hardware?
Yes, they have not won a championship.
Right, right.
But they're really good. What's interesting, though, about this, couple things. Let's take Penn State. Bill O'Brien is the number one paid employee in the state. You're saying my tax dollars? No. That's where this is misleading. your tax dollars are not going to pay his salary at all. Now, in many of these states, that probably is the case, where tax dollars go in and so forth, and there's a crossover between athletics and the university. Penn State's athletic department is autonomous from the rest of the university financially. So Bill O'Brien's base salary, which is what did they announce it last year? $950,975. He got a bump this year, so maybe it went from $950,000 to $1 million or something, whatever. Is paid from the athletic department fund. And because they're autonomous, it's revenue they generate through the football program, basketball profits, TV, and so forth. The rest of Bill's salary, which is what, another 1.3 plus, comes from TV and radio money from the Learfield contract, okay? So your tax dollars do not go at all into how he or his assistant coaches are paid. Now, why are they classified as state employees? Because they're part of the state pension plan. See what I'm talking about? They're part of the state pension plan. But how they get paid is through the athletic department fund, which is autonomous and money generated by the athletic department, football games, basketball games, whatever. All right?
I did like one of the other notes they made on the map. In Mississippi, it's difficult to track down salary information for employees at Ole Miss and Mississippi State, but the highest non-coach salary we could find topped out around $500,000. While we can't prove that anybody at these schools earned more than Dan Mullen's $2.65 million a year, we think it's very unlikely.
But again, his $2.65 million includes his radio TV money. That's not his base state salary. His base state salary, for all we know, is $700,000 or $1 million or 1.2, something like that. He's still the highest paid employee in the state.
But it proves
for the most part, most of these people we're talking about, you're saying, well, you mean the governor's not? Well, no, they've all had better years than the governor. So,
except maybe the hockey coach in New Hampshire.
Yeah, no, he had a better year than that governor too.
It proves, though, that you don't have to win to be highly paid.
That's true. Well, he does win.
He doesn't win the
ultimate
big one.
Game.
Yeah. He wins.
He'll win the ultimate game. He'll win the ultimate game. But if it were the ultimate game, then why do they play it every year?
Ah, that's deep. Way too deep for Friday this close to 5 o'clock.
Yeah. But that is... In Pennsylvania's case, it's misleading. Bill O'Brien does not get paid out of the state general fund. All the money that Penn State gets that's allocated by the legislature goes into the general education fund of Penn State. Not one dime goes to the athletic department. Zero. Zip. All the athletic department funds are generated by the athletic department. That's where he's paid from. As is Patrick Chambers and Guy Godowski and Cale Sanderson. Then, of course, they have added in whatever the Learfield contract happens to be. So that's not accurate.